This is a Vantage House production.
Hi folks, Jalen here. Welcome back. Today is May 3rd, 2025. If it's Friday, then this is The Delve. Bad news, everyone. After a difficult battle in the Republican-controlled Senate, the national total abortion ban has gone into immediate effect. President Donald Trump is poised to issue an executive order banning the abortion pills mifepristone and misoprostol this afternoon. To recap, in the last 100 days, the Departments of Justice and Education have been scrapped, right-wing militias have taken over the FBI, and through the Insurrection Act of 1807, the military has arrested Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Nancy Pelosi, Jack Smith, and Alvin Bragg. All DEI programs across the country have been slashed. Degrees in critical race theory and women and gender studies have been cut from all public universities. Refugees are only being granted asylum if they can pass a Christian faithfulness test. Russia has taken over the Ukrainian territory and is marching into the Balkans. Gaza is gone. Hi folks, sorry about that. Today is May 3rd, 2024. If this dystopian nightmare isn't here yet, but it's Friday, then this is The Delve. I wish I could say that that horror scenario was completely made up, but it's not. It is the explicit agenda of Project 2025, or the Presidential Transition Project. Cooked up by the Heritage Foundation with influence from the Claremont Institute and the American Society of Civic Renewal and other think tanks and secret societies that are broadly ascribed to Christian nationalism, their first 100-day plan is diametrically opposed to democracy. To be clear, Christian nationalism is not the national embrace of a love thy neighbor type Christianity. This is some dark sh**. Christian nationalists seek to establish a white, Christian, ethno-state where a few men control the government, the economy, the military, and the bodies of women. An authoritarian governance structure where children grow up as foot soldiers and queer people cease to exist. The people fighting for this are kooky. This isn't your grandfather's Republican Party. Once GOP icons Mitt Romney and Nikki Haley have now been excommunicated, even Liz Cheney is now a hero of the moderates. Her dad is Dick Cheney. Let that sink in. Donald Trump and his religious fanatics have infiltrated the think tanks, White House, Congress, school boards, and state legislatures. Here's a group of anti-abortion activists praying in tongues on the Arizona Senate floor. This blend of Christian fundamentalism, fear of, quote, great replacement, and a sense of persecution has radicalized the far right. But it's key to remember that Christian nationalism is in no way based on the teachings of Christ. There is a popular Christian phrase, be in the world, but not of the world. It's a concept explored by the most famous Christian convert, Paul. In Romans 12:2, he says, do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Paul is telling his followers not to chase pleasure, possessions, status, power. Be not of this world. The most worldly thing one could do is recast Christianity as something accommodating American nationalism, anti-immigration, and other discriminatory and harmful views. Jesus was not American. Jesus and his family migrated multiple times. Jesus was a friend to the poor and would probably be very unsupportive of a leader who was a billionaire and currently facing charges concerning hush money to a porn star. My guest today was drawn to evangelical Christianity as a teenager, and believed in the mission of Christian nationalism. In college, his eyes opened to how the faith that he embraced at 14 was being used as a vehicle for something much darker, a noxious brew of white supremacy, xenophobia, and patriarchal control, all disguised as Christian faith. Here I explain how a radical fringe has perverted and weaponized those beliefs into something truly dangerous and un-American. My guest, Brandon Nishi. And what a fun episode this was. Listen in. Brad, my, how I've been waiting to do an episode like this. You have no idea about Christian nationalism and Christians' influence in politics and all that good stuff. So do I have some questions for you? But before we jump into that, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and all that good stuff?
Yeah, so I am a professor by trade. I teach currently at the University of San Francisco. Also a writer and a podcaster. I have a show called Straight White American Jesus. We don't think Jesus was straight, white, or American, so don't worry. But we try to figure out why a lot of people do. And one of the reasons we do the show is, as a young person, I was part of a very right-wing, conservative Christian community. I converted when I was 14. I was a minister by the time I was 18.
Wow.
And by the time I was 20, I was married and in charge of a youth ministry of 200 kids and on my way to seminary. And so eventually left that movement after attending graduate school in England and other places. But I stayed in the religion game, so to speak. And so now for me, talking about Christian nationalism, talking about especially white conservative Christianity in the United States, is a matter of doing so as a researcher, but also as somebody who lived it. And it's kind of a bifocal approach. Somebody who's been on the inside, but now has spent, 20 years trying to figure these things out historically and sociologically and philosophically. So that's where I'm coming from when I talk about these things. I wrote a book called Preparing for War that covers a lot of it.
Mm.
And unfortunately, talk about these things a lot right now because they are things that are in our ether. So when people call me, it's usually bad news.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to talk a tad bit about your podcast. So Jesus isn't straight, white, or American. Walk me through this. What was Jesus?
Well, Jesus is born in, a place that we would call today Israel and or Palestine.
Mm.
He's a person who, if he showed up in the United States, would probably be considered a person of color, is somebody whose family endured going across borders and running from empires as a young person. So he's clearly not American. He's not what we would think of as your Anglo-Saxon white Protestant American. So I think that's one. I think two, that a lot of folks want Jesus to be a kind of patriotic, nationalistic savior.
Mm.
They take it beyond him being a white guy from the United States who speaks English. They want him to be a white guy with an American flag draped over him, a huge truck, a bunch of guns, and wearing a MAGA hat. And, we have really tried to figure out how you get somebody like Jesus who talks about welcoming the neighbor, loving all of humanity, building a kingdom based on compassion, based on loving those who society deems unlovable, to that kind of MAGA Christ. And so the straight part is the one that gets me in the most trouble. But, I think for us, it's important to point out that Jesus has, in the four Gospels, no romantic interests, is not married, has no partner. And so if you assume that he's straight, it is assuming that everyone is straight by default. And so we make sure to talk about the fact that the assumption of Jesus' sexuality is a strange one, given that he never had any romantic interactions in those four Gospels. And so that one gets us in trouble the most, but certainly the straight and white part, I think, are pretty clear to folks. Now, not everyone gets it. I do get emails from Fox News and MyPillow guy wanting to advertise on the show because I think they think finally a show for us. So I respectfully decline usually, but the emails do come in.
Wow. Does Jesus talk at all about sexuality or a way that people should be married?
So Jesus, famously does not speak about homosexuality, does not speak about, queer relationships, queer desire, queer love in any way. Jesus does have things to say about sexual ethics. He does have things to say about when and how you might have sex in terms of if you lust after somebody who is not your marital partner, then you're doing something wrong. So we could talk about that And that's one issue. Mm-hmm. But the issue of, can you point me to the place where Jesus condemns, you know, homosexuality or bisexuality or anything else? We don't find it. And so often people will then move on to the Apostle Paul. And one of my answers there is that the Apostle Paul says in Galatians 3 that there's neither male nor female in Christ. So gender is actually something that is not something we should consider a static category spiritually. In 1 Corinthians 6 and 7, he even talks about marriage as something that one should do only really out of a necessity for sexual release. It's not seen as the ideal form of life for the Christian person. So when people want to idealize a certain form of marriage, I often point them to the fact that if they were real Christians, they wouldn't be married at all. And that also gets me in trouble.
That's pretty funny. And now let's talk, I guess, a second about your book, Preparing for War. Can you give us a little breakdown of what that means?
Sure. It's an aggressive title. I don't want to prepare for war. I'm more trying to indicate that there's been a group of Americans for over half a century, really since the 1960s, who've been preparing for war on their own country, that they feel as if that's the only way they can take it back and get the kind of power and privilege they deem themselves to deserve. And so I really think that Christian nationalism is something we can talk about going back to the 1600s, the 1700s, the 1800s. I started in the 1960s because it's really a moment in the modern world that I think a lot of people can see the ripple effects into their own lives. In the 1960s, we have a lot of change in this country. We have the Civil Rights Movement. We have the Civil Rights Act. We have the Voting Rights Act. We have a fair housing law initiated. We have immigration reform. We have the feminine mystique appear in 1963. We have the Loving case that makes interracial marriage protected across the country. We have Stonewall. I could go on and on and on and on. A lot of white Christian nationalists at this moment see this as the time their country lost its way, that what they really want to do, and the data shows us this, this is not just me saying it, they really want to go back to the 1950s as the ideal time for the American Renaissance. Well, that's a time before Jim Crow ended. That's a time before schools were integrated. That's a time before all of the things I just mentioned that pushed the country in a way that for most of us felt like progress, even if it's unfinished. Mm. So I started in the 1960s and really try to trace what I take to be an extremist movement that has operated within the Republican Party to take power in this country by all costs. There's a vision for the country that says, look, it's not that people of color and non-Christians can't be here. It's just they need to know their place. They need to know that they're always going to be at a certain rung in the American hierarchy. We're the ones for whom this country was made. We are the inheritors of the founders. We have been given this country by birthright, and God has chosen this country to play an exceptional role in history. And so we're going to work every way possible to set the social order in the country back in place the way it should be. And if that means getting behind someone like Donald Trump in 2016 or 2020 or 2024, we will do that. Because what matters is power, what matters is order, and that for us is the vision of Jesus, even if it's not the vision of Jesus that many people would see in the Bible.
Who are the people behind this radical agenda?
So there's a lot of folks involved. It's a large network, but I think what I do in the book is try to hone in on a group of people that really joined forces. So if we think about the 1960s and 70s, we have two groups that really get together. One is a group who are really politically trained. They have been working in political campaigns. We can think of people like Paul Weyrich or Richard Viguerie, Morton Blackwell. They were all part, as like college students, of the Barry Goldwater campaign of 1964, a campaign that really set the tone for a far-right move in the Republican Party. Barry Goldwater is the man that said extremism is no vice and moderation is no virtue. So extremism is what you have to do if you want your country back. Well, he lost big time to Lyndon Johnson, but they never forgot that. So this group of political folks was also overwhelmingly conservative religiously. Paul Weyrich, for example, was a very conservative Catholic. He was so conservative that he did not accept Vatican II. He thought that the Mass should only be said in Latin. He thought that all things, including the family and the government, should be a hierarchy, a patriarchal hierarchy. And so for Weyrich, the goal was to, in his own words, revolutionize the social order, to overturn the present state of things. And he was trained to do that within politics. This is the man who started the Council for National Policy, the man who started the Heritage Foundation, which is obviously still around, the man who founded ALEC, the state-level policy initiative that proposes and creates laws and policies for state legislatures across the country, and so on and so forth. Well, they joined forces with a group of preachers and evangelists who had millions and millions and millions of followers, people that could offer them a whole demographic of voters that in many ways was untapped. So Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, Tim LaHaye, they got together with these Washington insiders and they formed what is known as the religious right. Well, their vision for the country was again to return it to the 1950s, to undo the movements of the 60s that in their mind ruined the country. That continued all throughout the end of the 20th century. So when we think about those who fought to get George W. Bush in the White House, those who opposed Barack Obama's candidacy and presidency tooth and nail, those who would love for there to be no gay marriage in the country, who would love to change radically our immigration policies, and so on and so forth, these are the inheritors of the religious right. These are the folks who are carrying out that vision that started in the 1960s. And the data tells us they're the folks who are voting for Donald Trump in 2016, 2020, and most likely 2024.
Wow. I'm kind of like blown away. I have these questions here and you're mentioning parts of them, which is really, really interesting. But I also have these thoughts pumping into my head at the same time. I imagine that there is this sense of hypocrisy in it too, and some of the vessels they're deciding to use. A vessel, say, Donald Trump, who would be very un-Jesus-like, but still they're going all in. Why? Because he gets things done?
Yeah, it's a great question. So this really started, if we go back to 1970s and the race between Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter was like built in a lab for a white Christian to vote for. He's like a Southern Baptist. He's born on a farm in like nowhere, Georgia. He marries his high school sweetheart. He's got his Bible in his hand everywhere. Yeah. He joins the military. Like he's a military man. And when his daddy dies, he goes home to Georgia and he like takes over the farm. Like what else do you want?
No.
You know, until Rosalind died last year, he's been married to his wife 70 years. Yeah. He's only had one like romantic interest. He's got a bunch of kids. He's
Sunday school teacher.
And yet they voted for who? Yeah. I mean, Southern drawl, you know, kind of a hokey guy, you know. And yet, who did they vote for in that election? Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan is from California. He's from Hollywood, a den of sin. He is divorced. He is somebody whose older kids not sure they really like him that much. His wife, Nancy, had an astrologist follow her around and give her advice at times. And no shade on astrology for me. I'm just saying most evangelicals think that that's like not okay. Why would you vote for this guy, not Jimmy Carter? Well, he promised them power. And he promised them that he would put the social order back in place, that they would stop abortion and they would stop women from clamoring for equality, right? So let's put that patriarchal order back in place. Check. Let's make sure that we put the social order back in place racially. Reagan launched his campaign in Mississippi where three civil rights activists had been killed. He was always using the dog whistle of welfare queens to signal his disdain for urban women of color, usually black women, who were, in his mind, living off the government. And he basically promised to renew America by renewing the racial order. And finally, he was a war hawk. He was like much more into war and American machismo and aggression than Jimmy Carter, the diplomat, the guy that wanted to dialogue and negotiate. So what they saw in him was a chance to renew the social order. And that to them, this is the thing we have to get clear. That is Christianity. Christianity is a society that functions according to what they think is God's order. So if Reagan promises that, we're going to vote for him instead of the Southern Baptist Sunday school teacher who went to the military and lives on a farm. So fast forward to Donald Trump. Donald Trump's even worse than Reagan. He's not a churchgoer. He's been divorced all these times. He pays porn stars to not tell about their affairs. He talks about grabbing people by the you know what, all that stuff. So why would you vote for him? Well, here's what I would say. By the time George W. Bush got done being president, he wasn't evangelical. He talked about God all the time, Jesus all the time. But the country was less Christian. It was more diverse. And there was gay people everywhere on TV and in culture and all that stuff. And then who did they elect? The guy that is made in a lab to scare the white Christian conservative, Barack Hussein Obama. Barack Hussein Obama's dad is black. His dad is from a different country. His kids are black. His wife is black. His name is Barack. His name is Hussein. He grew up mainly in Hawaii, which is like that even part of the country. I don't know. Do you have to change your money when you go there? Whatever. That's what a lot of people think.
Yeah.
And so now all of a sudden, gay people can get married and this guy's in the White House. So when 2016 comes around, they don't want Ronald Reagan, a charming Hollywood guy. They don't want George W. Bush, somebody who speaks with a Texas accent and talks about Jesus. They want a bully. Mm. They want a barbarian who will hurt the people that need to be hurt.
Mm.
Because that is what God wants. He wants a society ordered properly. So if you will do that, we will vote for you, even if you're not one of us.
Mm.
Even if you don't know your Bible verses or pray every day. Because you're going to do God's work. And you're finally going to make the people who have been ruining this place feel the pain they need to feel to stop doing it. So you're our guy.
And maybe some of it's you're going to make those people feel the pain that we felt, you know, during the 8 years of Obama. I mean, whatever that pain was, but.
Well, and that's the thing is, you know, you put pain in air quotes there and it's like, for them, there's really no sense of being free unless they are in control.
Mm.
So for example, you say, well, you're married, you're straight. Gay people can get married. Who cares? It doesn't mean you can't get married. Doesn't mean you have to stop being married. And I can point you to the sermons that I show to my students from mega church pastors, where they will say, my marriage now means less because gay people can be married. So what they're saying to you is, I can't be free unless society's ordered the way I want it to be.
Mm.
So just by dint of gay people getting married, I feel like my marriage is suffering. And when I show my students that, they laugh. They're like, that makes no sense. And I say, well, if you think that you can't be free unless society's ordered properly, then you're going to say, yeah, I suffered a lot during the Obama years. I was persecuted. I'm the victim. I'm the one who's being pushed to the side.
Wow. And then we have this thing coming up, Project 2025, to kind of get us back on track.
Project 2025 is something everyone should know about. I know that there's way too much to follow, way too much news, but okay, so let's connect the dots. You ready?
Yep.
Project 2025 is created by the Heritage Foundation.
Yep.
It's endorsed by Liberty University. That's Jerry Falwell. It's endorsed by Hillsdale College, by TPUSA, by so many right-wing Christian nationalist organizations. Project 2025 is the plan for Trump's 2.0. What happened in Trump 1.0 is that a lot of people were excited because they finally had their bully in the White House, but he's a buffoon and he messed a lot of stuff up and didn't get things done.
No.
He hired a lot of nitwits. You know, there was Scaramucci's and there was a lot of people that didn't know what they were doing. Jared Kushner had like 87 titles and was in charge of everything from Middle East peace talks to feeding the White House dog or whatever. So the point is, Project 2025 is the handbook. If Trump gets in again, just follow the handbook. Well, what does the handbook say? The handbook says we should radically expand the presidency to the point that the executive branch basically overwhelms the judicial and the Congress. And so Project 2025 is a plan for a large-scale executive takeover. It puts every federal employee on Schedule F, meaning if you're not a loyalist to the president, we can fire you at any time. If I ask you to do something that you say is illegal or not allowed, I'll just fire you and find someone who does. It outlines the possibility of using the Insurrection Act on Americans. It refers to the Department of Health and Human Services as the Department of Life.
Mm.
And it almost sounds like out of a George Orwell novel, the Ministry of Life. It says that the U.S. government should come out and say that marriages should be ordered in a certain way between a man and a woman. It says that the federal government should crack down on trans people. There is an idea here of withholding funds that Congress has appropriated for certain things just by dint of the president doesn't feel like doing them. What's the point? This is a terrifying vision for a president who feels like there is no way that anyone can stand in his way. It's also the fever dream going all the way back to the 1960s. Who created the Heritage Foundation? Paul Weyrich. Paul Weyrich was a radical right-wing Catholic who saw society based on patriarchal hierarchy. In my mind, Project 2025 is a design for a patriarchal hierarchy.
Mm.
Just put one man in charge of the government. get rid of the deep state, get rid of all the people that are standing in his way at the State Department. Make the DOJ his personal attack dog. If you do something wrong, I send my attack dogs from justice. They will prosecute you. They will sue you. Your life will be hell.
Yeah.
That is the vision for the second term of the Trump presidency. And you're like, well, I don't believe you. And my response is, go read the 900 pages. They're telling you what they want to do. It's all right there.
Yeah. If Trump was reelected, we're hearing kind of like some talk from folks who are really riled up from the Palestinian protests. And a lot of them are saying, I'm not going to vote for Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm.
I'm even hearing some people say, I'm going to vote for Trump.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Where does that camp fall on the Israel-Palestine thing?
Yeah. Where does the Trump camp fall? Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot to keep in mind when it comes to Trump and the Christian nationalists that I've been talking about today. They will always give full and unabashed support to Israel. And there's a number of reasons for that. One is Islamophobia, that if you have a country that is majority Muslim, they will automatically assume that country is evil. So you can listen to people like Nikki Haley or others talk about any country in the Middle East that is Muslim majority, and they just associate that country with terrorism, with violence, with etc. So I think Islamophobia should not be overlooked. There's also a sense that Israel is important in the history of the world because that is God's chosen people. That's how they view it as Christians. Now, the way I always talk about this is they have a love for Israel, but not a care for actual Jewish people. There's a difference. They fetishize Israel. Mm. They hold it up as an idea and as a thing that they believe is ordained by God. And yet, when you talk to them about actual Jewish people in their lives, whether that's in the United States, whether that's in Israel, whether that's anywhere, they will often tell you that they are misguided and that they understand what Israel needs more than actual Jewish people because they're Christians who know the Savior of the Jewish people, and these folks have not recognized Jesus as such, and therefore they are lost. So there's a sense in which they fetishize Israel, and yet they do not have a deep and abiding sympathy or empathy for Jewish people. What that means in terms of policy is you're going to see an even more full-throated and unabashed support for Israel's war efforts. You will see no sense of a call for ceasefire or any kind of understanding or empathy for the suffering of the children in Gaza who are dying every 10 minutes, the people in Palestine who are without water or food. You will simply see them lumped in with Hamas. You will see them all cast as terrorists, and you'll hear, as we've already heard from Lindsey Graham and others, that Palestine should be turned into a parking lot so they can rebuild it as part of Israel.
Yeah. So basically, if you think it's bad now, Trump 2.0.
Yeah. Like, and I just want to say clearly that I completely and wholeheartedly understand why anyone would not want to vote for Biden in light of what's happening right now. I'm also somebody who, because of what I study and where I sit, I see how many more people will hurt in this country and anywhere else if Trump is elected. And I know that there's people right now shaking their head and saying, it's six, one hand, half dozen the other. And I get it. And if we could sit down and talk for hours, I'd love to do that. I've done that recently with a bunch of folks.
Mm.
And I just cannot get away from what I think the Trump 2.0 will look like for anyone in this country who's a person of color, who's an immigrant, who speaks English with any kind of accent, who is queer, who is trans, who is bi, who wants to live their life in a way that is unfettered by personal cultural attacks, by folks who are on the margins and who are afraid of what might happen if those who want to attack and persecute them have the license to do so.
Yeah. How can we defend true religious freedom while still kind of battling this extremism?
I think one of the things that I've taken away from so many of my friends and who are clergy, who are religious leaders, is that freedom of religion comes from the freedom from religion.
Mm.
And that may not sound true at first listen. But the way that is easy to explain this is, look, if you want to practice your religion in a way that feels to you free and unfettered, what you want is for the government to not be a religious entity and not take a religious side. Because you're only going to give it the power to take one religious side over another, to impose one religious vision on everyone, and thus limit the religious freedom of those who don't agree with or practice that vision. So you may be a Christian, and you may think, well, it might be nice if the government was more Christian or had more Christian values. And I think my response would be, if you look back through history, there have been so many governments that have taken on Christian identities. And what that means is they choose certain Christians over others. So as long as they choose your Christianity, you might be okay. As long as you practice Christianity in the way that they see it should be practiced, you might be good. But what about when you don't? What about when you're not part of that group? What about when you want to practice your religion and it doesn't line up with the government says is good religion? Then you're in trouble. So when it comes to being religious, we want a freedom from religion on the part of the government so that everybody, Christian, Jew, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, agnostic, atheist, and on down the line can do their thing in a way that's free from interference. That means respectful. That means in accordance with the values of democracy, but it doesn't mean that the government has to stand on the scales of religious identity and determine what is a good American by determining what's a good form of being religious. That's not a way to be free, whether you're a Christian or not.
Are Christians waking up?
It just depends on which ones you're talking about. I do think that there's a lot of Christian people who recognize the value in what I just said. There's a great work being done by the Baptist Joint Committee to fight Christian nationalism because they believe that they can be free religiously only if the government is not part of religion. There's a lot of folks who are working to say that our faith is not about imposing itself on others, but by loving and caring for anyone, regardless of who they are. So I think people are waking up to the dangers of Christian nationalism. I think the fear that I have is that folks will simply think that Christian nationalism is, well, I love God and I love America. What's wrong with that? And my response is nothing. But if that means that you think to be a real American, you have to be a Christian like you, if you think that the federal government should impose your Christianity on all of us, that's more than being a Christian and loving your country. That's something different. Please don't tell me that those two are the same. One is saying, I love America and I love God. That's fine. The other is saying, because I love America and I love God, you have to love God and America the way I do. Otherwise, you're not American or Christian. That's not okay. And so I think there's a lot of folks waking up to that.
Say you have a loved one and you hear them spewing this stuff. What's an effective way to kind of break in, you know, help wake them up?
So the biggest temptation is going to be to tell them all the ways they're wrong. And I'm pretty tempted to do that. That's kind of how I operate. I like to argue. I like to have facts and data. And when I'm in a conversation, I like to say, well, what should we believe based on the evidence? And so when people start spouting conspiracy theories about QAnon or how the election was stolen or any of those things, my response is, look, I have done the thing where we argue on social media. I've done the 345 comment thread on Facebook with my friend from high school. And it does not convince them, I can tell you, from many nights up at 3 a.m. arguing with Jeff from history class 20 years ago. What might help them is something that takes a lot more patience and a lot more willingness to be present in ways that are difficult. I think you have to ask them about their emotions. And I know that might sound strange, but if you ask them, hey, why are you so angry? Tell me about it. And they're going to tell you things that are going to be disdainful about why they're angry. Could be QAnon, could be this and that, could be immigration, could be whatever. Hey, why are you so anxious about the future? Why are you so resentful of certain people? If you let them talk, they might let you talk in turn. They might let you, instead of saying, here's what I know from the New York Times or the latest data from Pew Research. If you say, you know, I'm anxious about this, or I'm really angry about this, or I really feel hopeful that my kids might have this kind of world to grow up in. There's a chance that you might be their cousin, their friend, their nephew, rather than what they've been told you are. Because what they've been told you are is a liberal, global, globalist, woke enemy of God and country who wants to eat their children.
Right.
Now, yeah. You have a demon inside of you. You smell like sulfur.
And you're not exaggerating.
I'm not.
That's the best part.
I mean, this all sounds absurd. And yet I can tell you, this is what they've been told about you. You're a communist, secular, globalist who probably got $1 million from George Soros and hates God and wants, you know, America to whatever.
Yeah.
But if the two of you get to talking about your hopes, your fears, your angers, your resentment, your injury, they might just be standing there with you at the barbecue as two human beings, right? As people that are nephews or colleagues or friends or cousins. And that relationship might be one where they feel a sense of kinship and safety to the point then when there's a little chance to say, hey, I see what you're saying there about Donald Trump or this or that. But I just don't see it that way because I think this happened and I'm not sure, you know, that's the only way you're going to find the opening. And it takes a long time and it may not be available to all of us because that it may not be safe. They may not be people you can be in relationship with because of certain identities you hold. And so if you can't do that, then this is not something you should do. But I just want to say that if you really do want to do this, it's painful. It takes a long time and you're going to have to suffer through a lot in order to find those openings to get through.
Yeah. I could talk about this all day, but I imagine that you do have some time limits. So just two final questions. Who comes after Trump?
That's a good question. I think that one of the things we need to be very aware of is there may never be another Trump. It's hard to replicate someone like him, but there are many who are trying to be Trump. Whether that is the person running for mayor in small town America, whether that is Josh Hawley, whether that is now somewhat out of the limelight, Ron DeSantis. So what comes after Trump may not be another Trump, but it's certainly a Republican Party that's made in Trump's image. And it will take a long time for that party to retrain itself, not to try to use all the lessons from Trumpism to get elected and to get ahead. And so what comes after Trump is a lot of wreckage and a lot of having to deal with what he's done to our democracy. But part of that is a whole party that has basically trained itself to follow his lead in terms of how it governs, how it tries to get elected. And it's going to take a long time for that to change.
Yeah. And final question, what makes you hopeful for the future?
I think what makes me hopeful is just, you know, what we see every time there's an election these days, every time something's on the ballot, what that could be reproductive rights in Kansas, that could be a Supreme Court seat in Wisconsin, that could be a trans candidate running for the state legislature in Delaware and Virginia, that could be a mayoral race in Boston. We see people that continue to hold out the vision for the American experiment. We see people who say democracy is about sharing power. Democracy is about having faith that we're all going to keep that agreement and we're going to pursue something that we think is better if we all agree to share that power. It's fragile, it's vulnerable. There's always people that are going to try to take more power than they should. And we've never lived up to it as a country and we've never really even gotten close. But we're going to keep trying for a more perfect union. And that may sound corny, but we can give in to the tyranny of fear and election nihilism, or we can say we're not going to give in to the tyrants of fear. We're going to live lives that are more than being scared of the big bad others they're always trying to tell us are out there to get us. We're going to live lives that are not life negative, but are world affirming, that say we are going to build this rather than be afraid of that.
Yeah.
And that's what you see when you see a Black mayor being elected in Wilmington, North Carolina, or an Asian American woman being elected mayor in Boston, or reproductive rights finding hope at the ballot in the Midwest. So that's what gives me hope. And every time I'm with people, whether they're Christian, whether they're Jewish, whether they're secular or humanist, that feeling of us working in that experiment, carrying forth that agreement, and continuing to try to live out that vision, as bleak as it may sound, that is something that will give you hope. And it's something I hope we can all find as we move forward here up to November.
Awesome. Brad, I really enjoyed this. I'm not kidding. I could talk longer, but I'm not going to do that to you. Thank you so much for joining us here at the Delve. You were incredible. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
For sure. The 2024 presidential election may represent one of our last bastions of defense against these anti-democratic forces. Project 2025, the Heritage Foundation. We'll be delving into some of these insidious groups in a series leading up to the election. Stay tuned. Thanks to Brad for coming on for this awesome episode. Very special thanks to Gene for his research and writing, Madison for her editorial and production support. Shout outs to Javon, Dan, and Eli for their sound magic. Thanks for listening in. Tune in next week for our season finale, if you can even believe that. I'm Jalen. This is The Delve. I'll see you next time.